Liam Riley there from Bagatelle. Okay, friends, I'm going to link up now with a friend of mine for some 40 years, and neither one of us are bragging about it. But here was a fellow, and when I met Neil O'Dowd first,
1847.
Yeah, it was, and it was on a Wednesday. Yeah.
Tuesday,
yeah. Oh, it was Tuesday night, yeah.
Yeah.
That was it. But one of the things that I noticed about him is he was a bit of a raggedy, you know, like a ragamuffin.
He was a hippie.
Yeah. Yeah, I did, honestly. Yes. You know.
I had long hair and cowboy boots. And
oh, yeah. And came from, by way of San Francisco. Neil O'Dowd, you're very welcome.
Thank you, old man. I appreciate that. I'm so sorry to hear about Liam Riley.
Yeah.
That was such an anthem, that song, for my generation.
Yeah.
It was like one of the great songs ever written by an Irish guy.
Yeah. And it would be, I think, fair to say that a lot of the groups that surfaced around that time, they were dubs. They were from Dublin, and
that's right.
And in fact, you know, crossing the Shannon, that was, you know, listening.
It was long before the Waterboys and groups like that.
Yeah, but made a tremendous impact, you know, in an Ireland that was still fighting the Camogie type songs. And, you know, they thought that had more to do with immigrants and particularly America. You know, a little earlier in the program, I played the Irish Soldier Boy there. And, I want to start by asking you, how did you wind up in San Francisco to begin with? Here you are, you know, immigrants would come to New York, to Boston, the traditional Irish-American cities. What, you were a teacher in Ireland.
I was a teacher, and I was a pretty okay Gaelic footballer, and I came out for the summer to play for a team in Chicago, and got very friendly with one of the players on the team who was heading out west to California to live with some relatives out there. So kind of without really thinking, because I was 23 years old, I just said, why don't I go along? And it didn't seem anything odd to do at the time, because there was really very little going on in Dublin. And it was a different country, Ireland, back then, as you well know. So
yeah.
Headed out west, went to San Francisco and absolutely loved the climate, and just the feel of the place was so different to what Ireland was at the time. So I stayed. I stayed 6 years there, and six of the best years of my life. So I was very fortunate. And like all big decisions, I made them on the spur of the moment. I remember being in a Greyhound bus terminal at 2 a.m. with one bus going to L.A., and one bus going to San Francisco, and picking the San Francisco one because my friends had gone previously, but I was toying with the idea of living in Los Angeles. So that's how your life gets decided, Adrian, and thankfully it all worked out well. But I do remember when I came back to New York and starting Irish America magazine, just how incredibly helpful that you and your people were in terms of basically getting me on the map. And I go so far as to say we wouldn't have succeeded were it not for your support at the time back in, can you believe this month, or last month rather, is the 35th anniversary of Irish America magazine. So that'll tell you how
incredible.
Long.
But Neil, can you tell us perhaps a little bit about your decision to get into journalism, to produce a newspaper? Sure. I mean, you were Johnny Come Lately in the San Francisco area, and your determination, you know, to produce a newspaper, an Irish American newspaper, with a different, very different angle, in the sense that most of the newspapers that we had here, in particularly in New York and some distribution across America, were Catholic, conservative, cautious in...
Cautious is a very good word, eh? That's exactly what they were. They were unchanged for 50 years, basically. When I went to California, it was the beginning, if you remember, that was about 1979, and in the early 80s, a lot of young Irish left Ireland for America and Britain and Australia because of the terrible economy. And there was a lot of them coming into San Francisco, and, you know, San Francisco went from 3 Gaelic football teams to 8 in a space of 2 years. So it was obvious to me, this is way back before even a fax or certainly a computer, there was an information gap that young people really wanted to keep in touch with. Just the scores, football from home, hurling from home, and just the news and community news in San Francisco, who was winning the GAA games and all that. So being young and footloose and with no obligations to anyone, myself and a partner started a small paper called The Irishman, which we were very fortunate with. It hit at the right time and it took off. And I'd always wanted to go into journalism. I hadn't pursued it actively, but when I came to America, I saw the opportunity. So that was it, Adrian, 39 years ago.
Yeah.
40 years ago, actually. So,
that's
how you get started, and that's what I always loved about America, was the feeling of being able to do basically whatever you wish to do. And if you didn't make it in San Francisco, you could always go to Boston or Chicago or New York. And there was never that kind of freedom in Ireland. You were basically stuck in the big city of Dublin was really the mainstream, and that was it.
Yeah. But it took, you know, a particular amount of nerve to, you know, to start in coming to New York to establish, you know, a very high-class, glossy magazine at a time when, you know, newspapers were at some radio programs across the United States. But the notion of a magazine, that was a pretty high bar, you know, in terms of aspiration as to what you might do here.
Well, it was very interesting. The origin of it was standing at a newsstand one day in San Francisco on the train station and seeing a magazine called Attenzione, which was aimed at Italian-Americans, a very glossy, upmarket magazine. And I thought to myself, maybe that would work in a city like New York for the Irish, where there were so many Irish, and not just Irish-born, but, as you well know, millions of Irish-Americans interested in their heritage and history and the background of various stories and who loved Ireland just because it was where their people were from. And I didn't feel they were getting catered to by the weekly Irish publications, which were really just dealing mainly with Irish organizations like the AOH or the county associations. So Irish America was an attempt to tap into a different audience, and fortunately it really did from the first issue tap into that audience, and it was very successful. And as you know, a couple of years later we started the Irish Voice, because just like in San Francisco, a huge group of young Irish had started to come into America, and we wanted to reflect what they were like and what their interests were. So,
yeah.
But behind it all, Adrian, was, you know, when you're a young person, I mean, I knew there was nothing back in Ireland, really, at that time. And I knew that if it didn't work out, the beauty of America was, for a young immigrant, there was always another city or another town you could go to and start up if you didn't succeed. So I don't consider it a very brave decision. I consider it one that was pretty obvious. If what I wanted to do was get into journalism, was to grab the thing by the scruff of the neck and just jump in.
Yeah, as we would well know here, you can have some great ideas and aspirations, but somebody has to pay the freight. Somebody has to, you know, pick up the tab. And the first thing I think you have to do is, you know, go to where the money is and sell that concept to somebody, you know, who would know that, you know, you as the ultimate startup, presenter, they would have to get behind you as well. And I think we all have a story. Mine, with respect to the radio, was going to Patrick's Pub and meeting Frank Mokler. And see if if you could get, say, some startup money. And I remember, you know, Frank Mokler saying to me, well, you know, what does it take to get you through the first 6 months? And I put a wild figure on it. It had nothing to do with anything. And he said, okay, here's what the deal is. I will advance you 6 months. And at the end of the 6 months, if you're still around, then, you know, you'll give us enough advertising here and we'll call it a day. And it was more of a shock to me, I think, than it was a, you know, okay, ideas are a dime a dozen, but here's one. And that's how I got started. Who did you go to initially in terms of coming up with the aggregate, with the seed money?
It was Bill Burke from the Bank of Ireland, who was even then a legendary figure in terms of helping start up Irish businesses.
Yeah. And from
I went into Bill and I explained what I wanted to do soon after I arrived in town. And he said, I always remember, he said, we'll take the back page for 6 months, just exactly like you and Frank Mokler. That was the make-or-break moment, because right then, if you had Bill Burke behind you and you had the Bank of Ireland behind you, it meant a tremendous amount when you went to other advertisers and you said, well, Bill Burke is behind us and he's taken the back page. So you always remember the people who jumped in first, as you were the first person to help us in terms of the media. Bill Burke definitely, you know, sort of gave the heads up to people that this was a good publication and could be supported. And then in later years, of course, we had some wonderful people like Don Keogh.
Oh, yes.
Coca-Cola, who took the back page in Irish America magazine for 5 years. 5 years. And told me it was for 5 years. And you can't beat that kind of friendship and partnership. And when you went to people again and said, well, Coca-Cola, I've taken the back page. It just has an instant knock-on effect, which is exactly what Bill and Don knew. But those are two people who would stand out to me, Adrian, who were just so very good to me at the beginning.
Neil, when you started the newspaper, of course, Irish America was considered to be catering to, you know, to a group of people like you have pointed out. Those interested in Ireland, those interested in culture, those interested in their roots. But when you started Irish Voice newspaper, it was considered at the time to be not only different but radical by comparison to the other newspapers.
That wasn't very hard.
But
by the way, before I forget, I have to mention Bill Flynn too from Mutual of America, who was a tremendous supporter of the magazine from a very early
absolutely
day.
Yeah.
And later on Tom Moran, who were two of the finest people I met in my life, and they were so great, not just to me but to the community generally. But no, I mean it was radical only in the sense that the other newspapers were very, very narrow and conservative. And I just felt reflecting what young people in Ireland were thinking was important, particularly the young people who were ending up over here. And if you look back historically, I wrote a book about this, as to how, you know, Catholicism was very rigid and very, very hard to overcome in terms of rules and regulations. But beginning in the 80s, it's starting to loosen up and people started to think differently. And my God, women started wearing miniskirts and things like that. And people like you were appalled and ran off to church.
Oh, absolutely.
I know that. Cause
as a matter of fact, I still had that image for some reason.
I showed up in a bikini down in Rockaway and you were so I'm talking from the truth here.
Your involvement, I know you've given me compliments, which I appreciate very much, and you notice that I kept very quiet when you were talking about how influential I was. But I wanted to just talk a little bit about Irish American Magazine and Irish Voice newspaper and your use of both of those to tackle and to point out the atrocities in Northern Ireland and to bring in, you mentioned a couple of them already, the Tom Morans, the Bill Flynns, to bring those, not just their support, but to involve all of them in Northern Ireland and not only introduce them, but to have them take some of what the image of Irish America was, and that is that they were all going around pubs collecting
right.
money for guns and ammunition and the IRA. Was that a hard sell? How did you isolate, people who perhaps would have, more credibility and be able to bring their influence into the Northern Ireland situation?
Well, I think, and you know this better than anyone, the mainspring for me was the issue of the Irish Undocumented, where I saw the power of the community when it came together in winning over the Morrison visas and the Donnelly visas and, helping our young undocumented become legal. And we ended up with about 40 or 50,000 visas. And that was a great struggle. And the people who helped were not all the usual suspects in the Irish-American scene, like people like Chuck Feeney, who was a billionaire, who was passionately interested in Ireland, who everybody knows gave all his money away. Incidentally, there's a wonderful article about him in this week's issue of America, the Jesuit newspaper, about his philosophy of giving while living. But attracting people like him, like you say, Bill Flynn, Tom Moran, first of all on the immigration issue, and then sort of buoyed by the success of that and seeing what we were all able to achieve, saying, maybe if what we did on the immigration, which is create a grassroots movement, and bring in people on top of that grassroots movement who were very, very prestigious and well-known, not just in the Irish community, but in America. If we tried that with Northern Ireland, which had reached a deadlock, and we brought in America as the outside player, which I always felt was going to be the winning move, that things would be very different. And that's precisely what happened, because we brought in people like Bruce Morrison, we brought in people like Chuck Feeney, we brought in people like so many wealthy Irish-American business people who were passionate about Ireland but did not want to get mixed up with IRA activity and who welcomed the opportunity to go and help out in a way that had nothing to do with violence but had much more to do with creating political influence. And, of course, that hugely came down to the fact that President Clinton was elected.
Yeah.
And he became a great friend of Ireland very early on, thanks to the hard work of a lot of people. And so there was a natural progression between helping the undocumented and trying to find a solution that we could be helpful for in Northern Ireland.
Now, you did, you did have... and did earn the reputation. Sometimes it gets buried in the midst of the history of the great support needed to bring, about the Good Friday Agreement. But you were the conduit for a lot of the people that you have mentioned in terms of actually going to Northern Ireland, meeting the principals, and establishing that connection. Risky at the time because it was very new territory. But you were it. At times, did you feel like this thing is going to get screwed up and I'm going to take the rap for it?
But every day. at the height of it, it was very, very iffy as to whether it would work at all, because a lot of people were dead opposed against America becoming involved. The British were actively working against us, particularly in terms of trying to limit our influence on President Clinton. But I never weakened in terms of believing the message was the core. And the message was Irish America can help bring peace to Northern Ireland by coming over and making people understand just what was at stake, that the President of the United States was now involved, and the good things that would flow from that. And of course, that was proven to be correct, particularly with the appointment of George Mitchell, because without George Mitchell, no peace process. Without President Clinton, no peace process. Without Irish America, no peace process. And those were all things that I have to say I felt were definite anyway, but it took a lot of convincing of other people to make them see it that way, that Irish America and all its great support, and not just the IRA gun runners or anything to do with that, but people who were very well up in business and academia and history and understood Ireland, getting involved at a level that, frankly, Northern Ireland had never seen before. And I think that was one of the levers that opened the door to the Good Friday Agreement, Adrian.
Of which, again, as I say, there, you know, let history record you, Irish American Magazine, Irish Voice newspaper, that carried a tremendous amount of influence. Not always appreciated here, but I would like to.
You can ask Frankie Byrne and people like that.
I want to tell you, and dragging me down with you, I was disavowing any, you know, between. You on one side, Malachy McCourt on the other.
You always want to be Grand Marshal.
That's true.
Now that the poor present Grand Marshal is going to be 3 years before he gets to March.
Oh, boy. Yes, indeed. Can we fast forward, though, to the hopes and aspirations that we have? You know, many of us, and you're up there with Brian O'Dwyer and so many others, in your great support and endorsement of now President-elect Joe Biden. And then, typical of Neil O'Dowd, he gave him an awful rap recently in terms of, you know, his lack of follow-through, you know, brings us back to the Clinton, era when great success and the friendship of and commitment of Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
And then he was hardly in the door when you had the Paul O'Dwyer's and everybody else saying, excuse me, I thought you were supposed to be doing something. What the hell is wrong with you? You know? Why, you mean we're not in the day one category here? On Joe Biden, tell us, what was bothering you at the time when you wrote that article?
It was very recent, but there was an article in Politico magazine saying that a very important job of Secretary of Labor was up for grabs, and that the Boston mayor was very much the leading candidate, Marty Walsh, to take the job. But there was a big but. Because he was a white Irish American, that would tell against him, because given the kind of cabinet that Joe Biden has, he's trying to racially and gender-wise balance it. And I thought that was a load of hokum, to be honest, because Marty Walsh is the man for the job, and it's got nothing to do with race or his creed or his background. He is a union guy from top to bottom. started his life as a working man, became a key member in two very large Boston unions. He's known for his decency and his honesty with everybody, and very successful mayor of Boston. And I said, this is clearly the best guy for the job, and for Biden to put him aside, not on the basis that he's not good enough, which is one criteria that you have to agree with, but on the basis that he's an Irish guy and he's white, would be very, very wrong. And my position got an awful lot of support, Adrian.
Yes.
A lot of it from people who don't normally agree with me, I have to say. But I just, as much as, you know, you see radicalism on the right, I don't like radicalism on the left either, where it's they say, you know, because I'm this, I have to get that. That's not the way politics or life should work. The person should be judged on their ability to do the job. And good luck if it's an African-American or Asian-American or whoever. But Marty Walsh is the best man for Secretary of Labor. There is no question. Anyone you talk to with any knowledge of politics will tell you that. He's an impassioned speaker. He's very good on Ireland. He is brilliant on labor issues. And it just seemed to me that Biden, who I know is personally friendly with him, was probably being influenced heavily by, you know, the gender and race brigade who, you know, Ocasio and these people probably represent more than anything, that they didn't want a white Irish guy in the job, and I thought that was wrong.
Yeah. And as I say, there are so many who would agree with you on that, but not take the plunge and say, well, could you let the guy get in first? Actually, you can't, because the cabinet has been, you know.
That's right. There's three jobs left in the cabinet. And Attorney General, which is a huge job.
Yeah.
Secretary of Labor, which is a great job. I don't know what the third one is, but,
you
know, it's down to the wire, and it'll be announced, obviously, next week after the shenanigans with the Republicans are finally at an end, and Biden is incontestably the next president of the United States. Then the other decisions will be made. But I do think, and it's not, I don't really know Marty personally, but I've met him, so it's not a personal thing, but it's just observing the guy and knowing his reputation that I think he would be the best guy for the job, bar nobody.
Ken, you probably know a hell of a lot more about the significance of Brexit, and finally at the 11th hour, the you know, 59th minute of the 11th hour, a deal worked out with Brexit. And for most of us, the celebration and the reaction was great. There will be no hard border in the north, in Northern Ireland. End of story. Thank God for that. Without knowing, you know, practically anything at all about Brexit itself, how did it come about? Were there regrets along the way? And how do you think it was handled at the last minute? All right, we're having difficulty. Hold on for a second.
Sorry.
Okay, now there you are. See, was that was your fault, not ours. We had our glitch, you know, much earlier in the program. So.
I know.
Okay.
I'm used to your glitches. The fact is, Brexit is a triumph for English nationalism. It's a triumph for the Murdoch-type tabloid press that always proclaimed that Britain was at the centre of the universe and had no part of being part of some shoddy European continent that had countries like frogs in France and krauts in Germany and people that they disrespected deeply. So there was a poll taken and about 5 years ago, and Brexit passed very narrowly that Britain would leave the European market by 51% to 48%, which is 3 points difference. Now, on the back of that, it became a very interesting observation that the question of European membership for the United Kingdom was at stake. And if you look at the polling results of Brexit at the election time, sure, it won 51-48, but Brexit lost in Scotland 62-38, and it lost in Northern Ireland 55-45. So Scotland and Northern Ireland did not agree with leaving the European Union. And when they contested in the British High Court and the British Supreme Court that they were not consulted and that they had no role in deciding that the United Kingdom would fundamentally leave the European Union, basically the British Supreme Court said, you have no standing, you have no rights, it's negotiated by England, and it's England's right to do whatever they want. That is exactly what the verdict was, Adrian. Despite the fact that the Scots and the Irish made very clear they did not want to leave Europe, the Northern Irish, that they were in favour of European unity and working within the European structure, the English nationalists who drove this said the only opinion that's important is our opinion. And you must put this in the context of what has happened over the last 20 years, both in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, where local parliaments have been allowed to basically handle all the local issues. But those local parliaments, particularly in Scotland, always felt that they were entitled to a say in what the entire country was doing. For instance, Scotland has a large number of MPs in the British Parliament. But what the Supreme Court found and what the Conservative government did was completely ignore any aspect of the objections or the insights of Northern Ireland and Scotland on this issue and decide to go ahead themselves on behalf of England and on behalf of the rest of the European of the United Kingdom to withdraw from the European Union. And that has left things at a very, very dangerous point for the United Kingdom, to the point where I will make a prediction now that I'm very confident of, that within 5 to 10 years Scotland will no longer be a member of the United Kingdom, and that within the same time period there will be a referendum in Ireland on whether or not Northern Ireland should remain part of the United Kingdom. And Brexit has brought those two issues to life. And you find that the Scots in particular are very adamant at the moment that they have been waylaid and misled and left out. And there's a Scottish Parliament election next year at which it is confidently expected that maybe as high as 70-75% of the seats will go to Scottish nationalists. And if that happens, they will then bring in a referendum. And the young people of Scotland in particular have made it clear that they feel that the English have tried to basically put them in a box and say, you're not important, we don't care about you, and that Scotland will vote to go back into the European Union and separate from Britain. And I think that would be a huge factor. And I also believe that Northern Ireland, when this Brexit thing starts working, Northern Ireland will have the very same reaction, that they're wasting their time, because the only people who are important to the Tories are the English themselves, the English nationalists, and that's all that they're catering for.
Neil, I want to ask you about the impression that some might get that the only thing that those in Northern Ireland are concerned about is, number one, no return to the border, and that somehow, if not to a degree by default, we might wind up with the United Ireland anyway. Again, that we are still playing second fiddle to the UK and to Mother England.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that from now on, Adrian, if you're driving your car from Northern Ireland into Britain, from Northern Ireland now I'm talking about, you have to be stopped, you have to go through red tape. If you have a business, which a lot of people have, that exports to Europe, you will have to go through red tape and regulation that will be incredible. If you are Northern Irish and you want to go to France where you could go without a passport before, now you cannot do that. So it basically comes down to life is not going to get easy for people who are still within the United Kingdom, because, you know, the regulations and rules, like now a truck can leave London and be in Paris in the morning after, Well, what's going to happen is that that truck will be stopped at least three times at the customs, an inspection of their goods, and then they'll have to write up a ledger of what they're importing. So you're going to have huge delays. You're going to have, like, for instance, I was talking to my brother yesterday who is basically retired, living in Spain in a community where there's a lot of English expatriates. And all those English now have to go home and apply for their residency in Spain, whereas before this they were part of Spain because they were part of the European Union. So the repercussions are only beginning to be felt, and they will be tremendous when they happen, and I think it'll turn out to be an unmitigated disaster for the English, not just in terms of Scotland and Northern Ireland eventually separating, but also in terms of their own internal dealings with the European Union, that the amount of red tape and the amount of laws and regulations that will have to be enforced, because you're essentially going from one foreign country to another now. You're not going to the one country like you were under the European Union. And all those rules and regulations about customs and borders and tariffs will suddenly come into play, and these businesses are going to be hit very hard by it.
Is there room then, before we put Dunta closed on the issue of Brexit, have we now, where is the leverage? How do we start now? Now that the, that reluctantly the deal has been made and everything is done. So where do we start now?
Well, I think you start working on United Ireland, because I think even the unionists, 55% of people in Northern Ireland voted to stay in the European Union. And they will realise very quickly that staying with Britain, where they're not considered important, where they're just considered to be a small little local council, basically, is going to hurt them tremendously economically. And what they're going to start doing is they're going to start, if say you're in Belfast and you're exporting to Paris, what you're going to do is you're going to drive down through the Republic of Ireland and catch the ferry at Wexford or wherever and go straight to Paris by sea. Whereas if you were going through Britain, you go through Britain, you stop on the way in, you go down through London and you go to the ports that go to France and you're stopped again and then you're stopped in France. It becomes a hugely heavy workload in terms of how it used to operate, where you could drive with no restrictions. So practically, as a matter of practice, it's going to be a lot more difficult for people in Northern Ireland to do business in Europe, which is their second biggest market after the UK. And they're going to find themselves in a very strange situation where they would rather be driving through the Irish Republic, where there won't be any barriers now because they've removed their on the Irish Sea, which is a whole different thing to discuss. But basically, it becomes a lot easier to increase your trade and benefit with the Irish Republic than it does with England.
Is there an immediate benefit to the Republic as a result of this, or is this something that we'll have to roll out nice and easy?
I think it's an immediate benefit in terms of Ireland is now the only English-speaking country in the European Union. I think that will weigh heavily on American companies, banks, like the Apples and the Amazons who already are there. But in terms of the ease of getting to Ireland and the ease of doing business in English, it's actually very much understated in terms of Brexit and the impact it will have, because if you're putting a new headquarters somewhere where the English isn't the first language, there's an automatic barrier there. Again, it's all about barriers. So I think Ireland will benefit greatly from that. And it will benefit greatly from the fact that it's still part of the European Union and access to the continent will be as easy now as it has been, which is literally show up at the airport, show your European passport, and it's like one huge country. It's like going from Montana to Nebraska or something like that. There's nothing stopping you along the way. So I think from Ireland's point of view, now there will be obviously big issues about tariffs on Irish goods going into Britain, and that is something that is not fully decided. But, people have said, and they're correct, there's no winners in Brexit. There's only losers, and which makes it a very bad policy to begin with. But it was one that was driven by this incredible jingoism and hatred of European things by the British, particularly by the Tory party and by the English nationalists who always consider themselves superior to everyone else.
Neil, thank you for your contributions to this program, you know, over the decades. And I'm most proud, though, of our friendship, and we leave it at that.
Yes, we've certainly been great friends, apart from the time that Mayo won the All-Ireland.
Yeah. Can I take back just what I said again? You know?
Sorry, I just couldn't.
You're bloody...
I had to do it for the new year.
You were, yeah.
And
yeah.
I had a bet with your late colleague, Frank Durkin, that I think I'm definitely going to win now. If Frank is in heaven, he'll be laughing. But I bet him that Ireland would be united before Mayo won the All-Ireland. I'm looking pretty good, Adrian.
Well, yeah, so far so good. Thank you, Neil. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adrian. Thank you, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. Yes, and to Debbie and yeah. Of course, to the O'Dowds far and wide. Okay,
God
bless.
Thank you.
Thanks, bye. All right. Neil, like him or not, calls stories the way they are. And he doesn't, not only does he not hold back, but most of what he says and predicts, you know, come true. So, again, great way to start the year by bringing on, you know, Neil O'Dowd, again, founder of Irish American Magazine, Irish Voice newspaper, and, of course, Irish Central. We didn't get a chance, nor am I going to go into it, but Neil is a writer, an author, and he's constantly writing. And in the midst of everything else we're going through, a lot of things get lost along the way. But, again... Neil O'Dowd, Irish Central, Irish Voice newspaper, Irish American Magazine, again, a great power and influence in Irish America.